Facebook.com. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Facebook was once touted as one of Silicon Valley's greatest success stories, but over the last several years, the company has been at the center of controversy after controversy. While the tech giant was connecting 2.8 billion people around the globe, the company was also mishandling users' data, spreading fake news, and amplifying dangerous and polarizing hate speech. In the new book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination, New York Times reporters Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kang reveal how leadership decisions enabled and then attempted to deflect attention from misinformation and hate speech. Time after time, Facebook's engineers were instructed to create tools that encouraged people to spend as much time on the platform as possible, even as those same tools boosted inflammatory rhetoric, conspiracy theories, and bubbles. While consumers and lawmakers focus their outrage on privacy breaches and misinformation, Facebook solidified its role as the world's most voracious data mining machine, posting record profits and shoring up its dominance via aggressive lobbying efforts. An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination, is the product of interviews with more than 400 people, the majority of whom are executives, former and current employees, friends, classmates, and investors in Facebook. Joining us to talk about the book is Shira Frankel, an award-winning tech reporter for the New York Times who covers cybersecurity. Hi, Shira. Thank you so much for this important book, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you and Cecilia write that the people who spoke to you often put their own careers at risk, and they were crucial to your ability to write this book. Without their voices, the story of the most consequential social experiment of our time could not have been told in full. Why did these people talk to you and give you so much inside information?
You know, a lot of these employees spoke to us because they care about Facebook, and I would say the vast majority of them really love the company and believe in its mission, but see really serious problems in Facebook's past behavior and what they call sort of ongoing problems at the company. They have spoken out before to their own managers, to their own executives, and they don't see things changing. And I think speaking to reporters gave them a chance, in their minds at least, to follow their own sort of moral compass and tell reporters what they saw as really significant problems at the company.
And as you write, this is a corporate culture that demands secrecy and unqualified loyalty.
It is. And what's so interesting is that, you know, internally, Facebook talks so much about transparency, how they have weekly meetings in which anybody can ask a question of the executives, how teams can sort of look in on each other's work. And that's all very true. However, they stress that what is in the family stays in the family. And they are adamant that their employees don't talk to reporters, don't talk to anybody from the outside. And if they are discovered to do so, they're punished, they're fired, and they're made an example of.
You spent more than 1,000 hours interviewing these 400 people. Why did you and your colleague Cecilia Kang want to get this story out? Because as we know, this kind of work really does just take so much of your life. Why was this so important to you?
Well, you know, as reporters, we had spent, each of us, years and years writing articles about Facebook. And together we wrote an article in 2018 called Delay, Deny, Deflect, which was really the first look at what Facebook knew about Russian election interference and how they, you know, did not go public with that information for quite some time. And after we wrote that article, we both sort of sat back and thought, well, we have so much left in our notebooks, so much left in terms of the scenes and the moments leading up to it, you know, what Facebook executives were feeling and thinking when they were in these rooms discovering, for instance, that Russia had in fact interfered in US elections, that it seemed worthy of a book. And we also felt like there were these ongoing patterns that, as reporters, we saw where a mistake was made or data was leaked, something happened, and Facebook executives apologized, and then the news cycle would repeat again and again and again. And when you see that as a reporter, you think, okay, there's a pattern of behavior here, or there's something underlying all these mistakes. And we want to get to the bottom of it. We want to figure out why these are not just one-off mistakes, but actually something deeper that's happening at the company.
Well, that really speaks to the quotes that you have on the back cover of your book. I think these just say so much. Mark Zuckerberg in September 2006, calm down, breathe, we hear you. Sheryl Sandberg in July 2014, we never meant to upset you. Sheryl Sandberg, January 2019, we need to do better. Mark Zuckerberg, May 2020, we need to do a better job. And you have about six or seven of these quotes on the back of the book.
Mm-hmm. You know, the decision to put those quotes on the back cover was made, I think, fairly last minute, in that normally authors have blurbs on the back of a book where another author or someone in the field reviews the book and then gives, it's often a one or two word thing like great read or exhilarating narrative or something like that. And we just, in this case, we kind of wanted to let the executives speak for themselves. And that pattern of apologies that you just read out, that like you said, that just speaks to so many of the problems at the company. These repeated apologies, which their own employees and people at the company are saying at this point are empty, because Facebook isn't making substantial and significant changes to make sure that some of these things don't happen again. They're hiring more security. They are hiring and expanding teams. But, you know, at its core, the company is still driven by growth. The company is still driven by moving and shipping products as quickly as they can. And we don't see them investing or changing their behavior and investing in, I'd say, safety and security as much as their own teams want them to.
Unfortunately, you could not get on the record interviews with Mark Zuckerberg or Sheryl Sandberg. You write that while Zuckerberg and Sandberg initially told their communications staff that they wanted to make sure their perspectives were conveyed in this book, they refused repeated requests for interviews. On three occasions, Sheryl Sandberg invited you to off-the-record conversations in Menlo Park and New York with the promise that those conversations would lead to longer interviews. But when she learned about the critical nature of some of your reporting, she cut off direct communication?
Yeah. Facebook is a company that is very used to controlling its narrative, and its top executives are very, very used to being very, I'd say very controlling, but that feels like an understatement. When Mark Zuckerberg gives interviews, he hand selects the people that he speaks to, and he tells them ahead of time which topic he's willing to speak about. He wants to control every aspect of Facebook's public PR, you know, and so does Sheryl Sandberg. And as journalists, that was just not something we were willing to do. It's not something we're ever willing to do. We won't let people we interview look over the quotes, for instance, for a publication. That's just not something we feel comfortable with. And we certainly won't let them direct what we're going to write. And I think when Facebook discovered that they weren't going to have that type of control over our book, one of their requests, for instance, was that they wanted to see the book ahead of time. And we said that we couldn't do that because we don't show articles to people ahead of time. We certainly wouldn't show a book to someone ahead of time. So when they found that out, they were not willing to participate.
I have to say, I'm so glad that I read your entire book because there were so many aha moments. But one of the moments that made me kind of scream out loud was on page 265, almost at the end of the book. And you write that well before U.S. government officials and much of the world were aware, Mark Zuckerberg knew that COVID was spreading dangerously fast. In mid-January, he began to receive intelligence briefings on the global spread of the disease from top infectious disease experts working at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. Dr. Tom Frieden, the former head of the CDC, and Joe DiRisi, co-president of the BioHub funded by CZI, reported that the Chinese government and Donald Trump were downplaying COVID and that the virus had spread to half a dozen countries. They basically said Facebook had such an important role to play here. I mean, This is incredible. When I read this, I wondered, why aren't we hearing more about this? First off, Shira, how did you learn about this?
We spoke to a number of sources that were involved in those conversations that were either briefed on it or in the room themselves when those conversations were happening. And to be honest, Mark Zuckerberg held fairly large meetings at Facebook when he got that information and asked his own staff, he mobilized his own staff to take immediate action. They launched a portal at Facebook to try to direct people to accurate sources of information. They got ready to shut down Facebook's own offices to keep their employees safe. So Facebook took immediate action based on the information it was hearing. Again, I think what we see here is you know, Facebook saw a moment where they could potentially be of help. They didn't foresee what their role was going to be in spreading COVID misinformation. And they certainly didn't foresee what it was going to be like when the president of the United States, who they had, you know, they'd given a special carve out to, was going to be the source of some of that COVID misinformation.
What's amazing about this is that Mark Zuckerberg, who was, I guess, probably 36 at the time. It looks like he's 37 now. Maybe he was 36 at the time. A 36-year-old has that much power that he is given this inside information from some of the top infectious disease experts in the world about a global pandemic that most of us, we really didn't know what was going to happen at the time. I think it just says so much about the power that he has.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly walked away from this book, from this reporting process, I would say, really astounded at how much power Mark Zuckerberg has. I think I can't stress it enough. He is singularly powerful in that not only does he stand at the head of a company that touches on the lives of over 3 billion people, but he has structured it in a way where no one can fire him or force him to do anything he doesn't want to do. He has absolute control over Facebook as a company. He's the majority stakeholder. He's the chief executive. The board that he has is one of just really being an advisory board. They can offer him advice and wisdom, but he doesn't have to follow any of what they say. And to sit in that position, right, to be able to make incredibly consequential decisions and know that even if you make mistakes, there's no one who can really hold you accountable. I don't know. I don't know that we've seen many people, certainly in our lives, who have that type of power.
Right. And also for people who might not be on Facebook or who aren't familiar with it, can you talk a little bit about just how effective Facebook is at trying to keep you on the site as much as possible and how effective it is at, you know, if you click on, well, I did actually search anti-vax this morning and I searched, I don't want to get vaccinated. And a lot of CDC information came up. It was actually pretty hard for me to find any sort of anti-vax groups. But Media Matters reports that it did find 284 active private and public Facebook groups. So just for people who are not familiar with it, just talk about what this company really does to reel you in and how effective it really is.
Sure. So, in terms of how effective Facebook is, I mean, I think the proof is in just how large they've gotten. They are the world's most dominant social media company, and they have gotten that sort of stature. They've become that large because they are incredibly effective at keeping you logged into the site for as many hours and minutes of the day as they can squeeze out of you and coming back repeatedly. I mean, that's something they look at, not just how much time you spend on Facebook, but how many times a day do you go back to Facebook or Instagram or, you know, WhatsApp. So they use technology which studies you as a person, and it thinks, well, what would this individual want to look at? What is the type of content that will draw this person in? And one thing that researchers have found to be fairly universal is that emotive content, content that inspires emotions in people, is addictive. It keeps people coming back again and again. And that's where misinformation comes into play. And that's where it connects sort of this anti-vaccine misinformation, other misinformation that you mentioned in the second part of your question, which is that even if you hate seeing it, even if you disagree with it, anti-vaccine content inspires emotion. And so you were mentioning how it was difficult to find anti-vax groups. I mean, the thing is that Facebook has finally taken actions where if you search anti-vax, you won't come up with anything. But these groups have masked themselves under dozens of other names. They call themselves Freedom Group or Group for the Freedom of Individuals, right? They have names which are not going to be very easy, certainly for Facebook's AI to find. I did a search a couple weeks ago where I joined one group for the common cold, just to say natural remedies for the common cold. And the next group that was suggested to me was an anti-vaccine group. And to me, that shows how there's still a massive problem. Not only do these groups exist on Facebook, but Facebook's algorithms are still recommending them to people.
Right. And you write about Renee DiResta, who is a disinformation researcher, and she did her own research on this and found that Facebook's own algorithms were their greatest asset. Once someone joined a group touting a natural health cure or holistic medicine, they were led down a rabbit hole where within a click or two, they were invited to join an anti-vax group. So that just begs the question. I mean, this is so widely known. Why is it that these groups are still active, given that Facebook has probably some of the best engineers working in the company?
I think part of the answer to that question is that these groups have been embedded within Facebook for so long. And for years, Facebook did nothing about them. There were groups, I mean, Renee DeRester, who you just mentioned, she was looking at these groups back in 2014 and 2015. So they have had 7-8 years to build a following on Facebook and a really entrenched community, while the company did absolutely nothing. And I think the second part of that is that while Facebook has specialized teams that look for these groups, it's kind of a numbers game. You know, sometimes Facebook will say things to reporters like, well, you know, we removed 95% of the content related to that. We removed 97% of the content. And that sounds like a hugely impressive figure. However, if you're talking about a million Facebook groups that get launched and Facebook only removes 97%, well, then you're still talking about a significant amount of groups that flew under the radar and managed to draw people in and spread their ideology. And so for a very, very long time, Facebook prioritized growth. Its security staff didn't have the personnel, it didn't have the resources, it didn't have the attention of executives that other part of the company had. And now they're sort of playing catch up. I mean, when you have over 3 billion people using your products, how many security staff can you possibly hire? Can you hire enough security staff to keep all those people safe?
Right. How many people do use Facebook's products? Because now they own Instagram and they own WhatsApp. So
right.
Do we know on any given month or week how many people use these products?
Those numbers vary quite a bit. And during their quarterly earnings report, Facebook will usually give some kind of report on those numbers. The figure that we tend to use is that across the family of apps that Facebook owns, it's over 3.5 billion people.
Wow. That is incredible. 3.5 billion people. Today, we're joined by Shira Frankel, an award-winning technology reporter for the New York Times. Shira is co-author of the new book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Shira, the other thing that came up in reading your book is what really matters to Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, given that they are so incredibly wealthy, you can't even imagine the amount of money they have. Facebook brought in almost $86 billion in revenue last year. So if you're thinking about companies spending $1 million here or $1 million there on ads or more, I mean, what is it? Because at this point, I mean, it sounds kind of silly to say, but they don't need more money. I mean, of course they do because it's Silicon Valley, but what is it? Like, do they want more clicks? Do they just want the eyeballs? Do they want to buy more companies? I mean, what is the end game here, given that so much damage is being done?
You know, I think the company's top executives, and by that I'm really thinking of Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, they are driven by this idea that ultimately their company does more good than it does bad. And that's, I think, a calculation they have in their heads, that they as a company, as executives of this company, feel like they can fix the problems that they've introduced. They're probably the only company that's big enough to fix the problems they introduced. And that if they look at the bottom line, they are doing more good in the world than they are bad. And I think Mark specifically is driven by this idea that history will see him as an influential person who introduced the world's first sort of global social network. He is very interested in how history will see him, not how the day's headlines will see him. That's something we've heard from so many people close to him, is that he takes a very historic view of his role in the world. And so I think a lot of the decisions he makes, and as you said, yes, he's not driven by money. He is an incredibly and almost unfathomably wealthy person. He's driven by power, and he's driven by still wanting to see Facebook grow and succeed. He is still that person that will look behind his shoulder to see the next, you know, big, exciting tech startup that's being founded and wonder how can he compete? How can he stomp them out? How can his company continue to grow and be seen as the world's preeminent social media company?
What about Sheryl Sandberg? It was interesting to learn more about her because over the past decade, she has been packaged as this sort of feminist in Silicon Valley that wants women to, quote, lean in and ask for what they're worth. You write that Sheryl Sandberg told Dan Rose, a former VP at Facebook, that she felt she was put on the planet to scale organizations. And when she was a high-level exec at Google, she was credited with growing the search engine's ad business into a $16 billion enterprise. And it's interesting to learn about, you know, her meeting Mark Zuckerberg at a Christmas party and basically saying that she wanted to turn Facebook into a profit powerhouse through innovative and pernicious advertising. I mean, not her words, that's what you wrote. But tell us more just about what really drives her in all of this.
Yeah, I mean, she's such an interesting figure, I think, because unlike Mark Zuckerberg, she did sort of brand herself outside of Facebook. And through LeanIn, through her book Option B, she went public with quite intimate details of her life and about, you know, who she is as a person. And I think in a way, people had this expectation of Sheryl Sandberg that not just in being the public face of Facebook, but in being so public about feminism and other things that were important to her. In writing this book, I had so many people say to me, well, I expected Sheryl to do better. I expected Sheryl to be the one that was on top of hate speech and misinformation. And then when we talked to people in the company, they were like, well, no, her job at Facebook was to grow ad revenue. Her job at Facebook was to make them profitable. And in that, she is hugely successful. I mean, last quarter, Facebook reported it is a $1 trillion company at this point. She's very good at her job, which is using Facebook's vast amount of data on people in order to run really effective targeted ads. She's very, very good at growing revenue for that company. The rest of the problems at Facebook, the hate speech, the misinformation, I think our book documents how she tries to be influential and have a voice in that, but she's often just not heard out.
It was interesting to read about her role with advertising. As you write, Facebook has a growth at any cost business strategy, and Sheryl Sandberg was the industry's best at scaling the model. Intensely organized, analytical, hardworking, and with superior interpersonal skills, she was the perfect foil for Zuckerberg. She oversaw all the departments that did not interest him: policy and communication, legal, human resources, and revenue creation. And drawing on years of public speaking training and on political consultants to curate her public persona, she was the palatable face of Facebook to investors and the public, distracting attention from the core problem. Expand on that one a bit, because she was the one that was brought out on a regular occasion to do media interviews.
Yes. I mean, she comes to Facebook at a time where Mark Zuckerberg, Mark is quite young when she joins Facebook. And employees like to joke that he was allergic to Washington, D.C. He hated going there. He didn't like being a public speaker. He didn't like giving press interviews. She, in a way, liked doing a lot of the things at the company that he was uncomfortable with. And so when she comes on, it's actually a great partnership for them, you know, in that she can do a lot of the things that he does not want to be doing. So we see Sheryl Sandberg join. We see her kind of handle parts of the company, including, I'd say, the business side, most importantly, but also being the public face, appearing at conferences, giving interviews to the press. She's the one front and center explaining a lot of the decisions that he's ultimately making. And I have to imagine that's part of the reason why, when Russian election interference happened, when Cambridge Analytica happened, people were so mad at Sheryl Sandberg, because even though Mark Zuckerberg was very much the head of the company, who, you know, really made a lot of the decisions that led to those problems, people saw her as really the public facing person there.
Right. And before we go to break, it's also interesting that, as you write, Facebook users are not there to shop, but advertisers could use the company's understanding of its users to convert them into shoppers. And what Sheryl Sandberg was proposing was essentially a whole new level of tracking.
Yes. I mean, that I think Sheryl Sandberg looked at Facebook and looked at the trove of data that they were sitting on and saw that those ads could be so much more effective, because Facebook understands you as an individual in a really sort of complete way. They see your whole ecosystem. So, you know, I often get people asking me whether Facebook is listening in on their phone conversations, or just, you know, can they use the microphone in their phones to listen to them, because they'll be having a conversation with a friend and then a few minutes later they'll see an ad on Facebook. And I laugh when I hear that, because my answer is always they don't need to. They don't need to listen to your conversations. They know so much about you already. If you, for instance, have a conversation with a friend in a restaurant about a vacation in Hawaii, not only is it possible that friend will then go on to Google Hawaii or message someone on Facebook about Hawaii, but maybe someone sitting at the table next to you will do it. And Facebook can see all of that. They can see the people around you. They can see the people in your physical proximity, in your social network, and therefore see, oh, well, this is an individual who might want to go on holiday to Hawaii because two people in her extended network have recently gone on holiday to Hawaii, and they'll show you those ads. They their technology is so advanced that they can even have predictive abilities. That's something else that we found quite interesting in our interviews, which is that they can look at you and say, okay, well, you know, six people in this person's inner circle or in their extended circle have gotten married in the last 18 months. And our algorithms, our information, our data is showing us that they are likely to therefore get married in the next, you know, whatever year themselves. And so we're going to start showing them these types of advertisements. They can understand things about you based on the people around you that you yourself may not be aware of.
One more question about Sheryl Sandberg before we go to break. You write about an incredible interview that happened between Sheryl Sandberg and Katie Couric in October of 2019. It was a Vanity Fair event. And toward the end of the conversation, Katie Couric posed the question, as you write, that few were bold enough to ask Sheryl Sandberg directly. Quote, since you are so associated with Facebook, how worried are you about your personal legacy as a result of your association with this company? Shira, first off, talk about this, just that moment, and then why Katie Couric posed a question that few were bold enough to ask Sheryl Sandberg. Why were so few bold enough to ask this question?
Well, I mean, I will say two things. One is that Katie Couric and Sheryl Sandberg had known each other for a long time. And so Sheryl Sandberg came into that interview perhaps without a lot of the preconditions that she puts on other interviews. I'd also say that at that point when that interview was given, Sheryl Sandberg hadn't given a lot of interviews to people. I think if she had, she would have perhaps asked that question by someone else because it's something that everyone was wondering. But after Cambridge Analytica, Russian election interference, Sheryl Sandberg just hadn't made herself available to journalists in that way. She had with Katie Couric because of their long history. And I think Katie Couric did what any, you know, good journalist should do in that situation, which is ask a question that's been on many people's minds.
And as you write, Sandberg did not skip a beat as she revered to the message she delivered from her first days at Facebook. It seems like it's hard for people to kind of get her off her talking points.
Yeah, she's incredibly well-trained. I mean, that's something that I can't remember if this made it into the book. At one point, there was a version of this book that was almost twice as long. But we spoke to people about her media training and just about how she creates these binders ahead of important appearances and runs through drills. She practices every answer. I've met her a few times now. She is incredibly on message all the time. And even when I think as a reporter, you sit across from her and you think, God, I really think she might be thinking something else than what she's actually saying. She still sticks to her message.
Wow. Shira Frankel is an award-winning technology reporter with the New York Times. She's co-author of the new book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are speaking with Shira Frankel, co-author of the new book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Shira Frankel is an award-winning technology reporter with the New York Times. She previously spent over a decade in the Middle East as a foreign correspondent, reporting for BuzzFeed, NPR, and other outlets. She and Cecilia Kang interviewed more than 400 people, the majority of whom are Facebook executives, former and current employees, and investors in the company. Shira, the other person I'd like to talk about is Sonia Ahuja. This was absolutely fascinating, just learning about the lengths that Facebook goes to either ensure that things inside the company do not get out or to ensure that they find out who leaked. So first off, I've never heard of her before, so thanks for introducing us to her. Tell us more about Sonia Ahuja, a former engineer whose internal investigations unit hunted down everything from harassment and discrimination complaints to leakers and whistleblowers.
A lot of her job actually entailed people who were leaking, not to reporters, but to other companies. And we have to remember that Facebook sits on a lot of proprietary information, a lot of innovative technology that other companies would love to get their hands on. And so they needed to form a department that was going to look for people who leaked to anyone they weren't supposed to. And as we spoke to people who worked there, quite a few of them said that in the early days, at least, a lot of the people they were catching were leaking to competitors of Facebook who were paying them money in order to try to get a leg up on what Facebook was doing. And so, you know, we see this department form. Sonia Ahuja eventually rises to the top of it. And some people within the company begin to call her the rat catcher, because when people are caught leaking, Facebook calls them rats. I think this shows how the company wants its own employees to think about leaking. And in our book, she features because Facebook goes on this hunt for who is leaking information to a Gizmodo reporter about one specific product, trending news. And they end up finding the individuals. It takes them a surprising amount of time, considering that in this case, the sources were actually, you know, quite closely related. They knew each other. They had even lived together in an apartment at one point. But we see them deploying methods which their own employees find oppressive. The surveillance of their own employees, I think, is really fascinating. I'll say as a reporter that when I go meet Facebook sources, I'm always warned, do not bring your phone with you. Do not bring your laptop with you, because they'll look at that kind of location information to see if you've been in close physical proximity to a person at Facebook who would have leaked something to you. And so I think their own employees are aware of just how closely the company is monitoring its own people.
It was so interesting to learn that Ben Fearnow, who was a contract employee for Facebook in New York, gave some information to a Gizmodo writer and said that he did not use Facebook Messenger. He used GChat. And when Ahuja invited him into her office, she was reading the messages that he sent the reporter over Gmail. And he basically said he was going to deny it, but he realized she knew. And when he asked her how she accessed his GChat, she told him she could neither confirm nor deny. So based on the reporting you've done, is Facebook looking at employees' personal email accounts?
Well, he laughed when he told me that story, because he said, you know, it was in that moment that he knew he was, you know, he was done for. He was thinking of denying it. And then she started to read him verbatim what he had written to his friend on GChat. I will say that, you know, he was on a work laptop, which had at one point been connected to Facebook's Wi-Fi. And so he seemed to think that that was how Facebook had seen those messages, that because it was one of their laptops, they had visibility into it. I cannot say exactly how Facebook saw the messages. It was just very clear to him that they were, in fact, seeing the messages sent on his personal Gmail.
Do you know, is this common in Silicon Valley, and not the wider Silicon Valley? Because we know that for many of us, if we have a work computer, our work has access to that information. But do other companies go to these great lengths to root out internal whistleblowers?
I think that a number of Silicon Valley companies take steps that I personally haven't seen done in other industries, maybe because they're technology companies and so much of their success depends on being first to market, being innovative, having the newest, most advanced technology. But, you know, having spoken to people at Apple, at Google, I will say that it is fairly on par with what those companies are doing as well.
Hmm. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Thomas in San Francisco. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Hi, and thank you for a wonderful interview. I apologize, I haven't read the book. As a matter of fact, I hadn't heard of the book until I tuned in this morning.
Highly recommended.
Excuse me?
It's highly recommended.
Oh, yeah, obviously. I remember turning the corner off of Portrero Avenue several years ago and seeing the name Zuckerberg on the public hospital in San Francisco. Mm. And I'm concerned about the amount of local political influence that these people, and I say people, not corporation, because it's obvious that there's a small group of persons who motivate these moves have in local politics? And I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Thank you. That is a great point. Shira, comments?
You know, I think for a long time, Facebook was not, in fact, invested much in local politics, and that did change, certainly, you know, with involvement in what is now the hospital that you mentioned. And in the area that they're based in Menlo Park, there's been quite a bit of reporting about what exactly is their influence there, how involved are they in the local community. But, you know, I think some people would like to see them be more involved. Some people would like to see them give back more to the areas in which they are based. It's just a question of exactly what the price is of that political involvement.
You, and I should say, thank you for the call. There was some news late last year about how San Francisco officials passed a resolution to formally condemn the name of the hospital. They wanted it renamed, saying that Facebook endangers public health with all this disinformation. But the vote doesn't have legal power, so the hospital does not have to change its name. But it's such a good question, Thomas. You write a lot about the political influence of Facebook in your book, Shira, and about how when Trump came to power, a number of people inside Facebook wanted to hire people who were close to Trump because they have very high-level Democrats and Republicans working for Facebook. What really struck you when you did that research?
I think that several things were interesting to us. One was that Facebook, I think really like much of the world, was surprised by Trump's win. And they weren't prepared for it. They had staffed their offices in Washington. They had made certain calculations. Certainly Sheryl Sandberg had made certain calculations, believing that Clinton was going to win those elections. And when they discovered that Clinton had not won, it was a scramble. And that scramble included looking at people in the inner Trump circle, as well as people farther sort of afield in the GOP, to try and shore up people within Facebook's offices that would be able to speak to this new administration. I think like many companies, they weren't sure what the Trump administration was going to look like, what their priorities were going to be, where they were going to focus their attention. And there was already discussion of antitrust. There was already concern of you know, whether Facebook would be facing regulation. They wanted to make sure that they were going to be able to influence the White House if regulation was in fact on the table.
And to go back a little bit, you write that when the House of Representatives flipped to a Republican majority in 2010, Sheryl Sandberg hired Rick Kaplan, right?
Joel Kaplan.
Thank you. I just have Kaplan in my notes. Thank you. Joel Kaplan, a former deputy chief of staff to George W. Bush, a former Marine artillery officer and Harvard Law School grad who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. So Joel Kaplan has a very high position at Facebook. And when Trump came into office, Joel Kaplan came up with a list of people he wanted to hire from the Trump team. And among them were Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, and Barry Bennett, a senior advisor to the campaign, who toured Facebook's office late in 2016. What was the reaction to that?
Quite a few people at Facebook were surprised to see him there. I think that he was an incredibly divisive and controversial figure. And so of the people who spoke to us, they said they were upset and angered to even see him in the hospital. I'll note that he was not hired. He was not offered a role. But I think, you know, it's to Facebook employees, it struck them as just how sort of rudderless their company was at the moment about what they were going to do vis-a-vis Trump.
You also write that Trump's team really knew Facebook. They really knew how to manipulate the platform. You write that they understood manipulation. Trump used it to post daily and sometimes hourly proclamations about the race. Meanwhile, his campaign was busily buying up millions of dollars in Facebook ads and navigating through Facebook's fine-tuned system to make sure its messages were constantly reaching voters. And it was raising millions from its supporters through Facebook. Talk about how important Facebook was to the Trump team.
Facebook was incredibly important because it gave them really granular data about their own followers. You know, Trump wasn't the first person to use this kind of A-B testing to figure out what the most effective messaging could be. He was just the very first politician to use it as effectively as he did. He in real time, when he was running his 2016 campaign, had people from Facebook sit in his offices. And by him, by the way, I'm saying Trump here, but I doubt Trump made these decisions. I think his campaign managers made these decisions. And in real time, they could give him feedback and say, okay, well, that messaging is playing well with women. That messaging is playing well in this state. That messaging is playing well with this particular audience. And they could constantly tweak and reevaluate what the messaging was going to be based on that feedback. And I think Trump, as somebody who says things that are unexpected and incredibly emotive, was sort of made for Facebook because, again, whatever he said was going to draw attention. Whether or not you liked it or hated it, you would probably interact with something outlandish that he said on the platform. And Facebook is sort of built for promoting that type of content.
Tell us about the relationship between Mark Zuckerberg and Donald Trump. You write that Zuckerberg's introduction to Trump's White House came from Kaplan and Peter Thiel. Zuckerberg had first gotten to know Jared Kushner, who graduated from Harvard the year Zuckerberg began. He scheduled an appointment with a senior advisor right before the Oval Office meeting to deliver a compliment. "You were very good on Facebook," Zuckerberg told Kushner, who helped lead Trump's election campaign. So tell us more about Trump's relationship with Donald Trump. I'm sorry, Zuckerberg's relationship with Trump.
Yeah. You know, Zuckerberg comes to that meeting with a bit of a gift, which is that data you just quoted. He tells Trump how great he is on Facebook. He tells Trump how large an audience he's reaching. And I think he knew going into that was going to play to Trump's ego. And I think that Zuckerberg, you know, in the sense of a chief executive, he plays this in a smart way. He knows that the president of the White House holds an immense amount of power, that he's talking about regulation. And so he wants to make sure that he comes out of that meeting with Trump on side. I think that it was interesting that it was him and not Sheryl Sandberg that went to that meeting, because as we show earlier in the book, I think in the past, she would have had a much more direct role and relationship with the White House. But in this case, I think Facebook correctly evaluates that it's Zuckerberg who should go, and Zuckerberg who'll be able to forge something of a relationship with Trump.
Well, it sounds like right now the Democrats don't think highly of Sheryl Sandberg, whereas before, if Hillary Clinton had won, there was a lot of reporting about how Sheryl Sandberg would have played a high role in the Clinton administration. You have this incredible story about that Nancy Pelosi video that was doctored to make her look drunk. And a high-level Pelosi staffer is working at Facebook. Pelosi and Sandberg, and I'm just going to give the short version of this because we're almost out of time, but Pelosi and Sandberg had a meeting. The video is shown. Pelosi's office calls Sandberg and says, take it down, thinking that of course she's going to take it down, and take it from there. What happens at that point?
You know, I thank you for giving that history. But, you know, I think what's important here is that Sheryl Sandberg has been working for some time to get Nancy Pelosi back on side and to, you know, create what was once a warm relationship to try and recreate that. And so when she sees that video, I think Sheryl Sandberg kind of, you know, she concludes, yes, this video should be taken down. Pelosi is right. Facebook should take down this doctored video, which is misleading people into thinking that Nancy Pelosi is stumbling and drunk. And she suggests that. But you know, this just goes to show Mark Zuckerberg's power. Mark Zuckerberg ultimately decides to leave that video up. He makes that call and nobody can persuade him otherwise. And despite it having a bad fallout for Sheryl Sandberg in Washington, despite really the press not even understanding that decision, they gave a very convoluted reasoning, which is that if it was outright manipulation, if it was a deep fake, if they were using AI to manipulate the video, they would take it down. But because it was sort of a lower form of technology, they wouldn't. And the example they gave is, well, if it was SNL, if it was Saturday Night Live, we wouldn't take it down. I think I was confused by that because I said, well, if it was SNL, it would be labeled as being SNL. People would know that they were watching a parody. This label isn't video, just isn't labeled as anything. People don't understand that it's manipulated. Either way, Mark Zuckerberg makes a call and then everyone at his company is forced to defend it. And that goes back to just how powerful he is.
Right. And you have so many stories like this in the book, Shira, about these videos being put up, blatant, false, dangerous information. And we get a behind the scenes take of the event, the meetings that happen between these high level execs who debate whether or not something should be taken down. I mean, I can't even, there's so many examples, but why don't we talk just quickly about the one that happened before the, let's see, Donald Trump campaign posted on Facebook the video of the speech that he made in Mount Pleasant in South Carolina. He promised to take a drastically hard line against terrorists and then link terrorism to immigration. President Obama, he said, had treated illegal immigrants better than wounded warriors. Trump would be different, the presidential candidate assured the crowd. Tell us just a little bit about what went on behind the scenes. Because as you write, the video of the anti-Muslim speech generated more than 100,000 likes and was shared 14,000 times, which is, you know, pretty low compared to some of the other speeches, which they just take off in a viral way. How did the company deal with that?
You know, I think what's important about that video, I'm glad you mentioned it, is that it takes off online. It takes off on Facebook and on other social media platforms. And the company's own employees go to their executives and they say, doesn't this violate our policies on hate speech? Isn't it possible that what Trump is saying right now would be removed if the average person said it? And Zuckerberg considers this and he holds meetings and he ultimately comes back and he on the fly at that moment says, well, maybe it does, but you know, we're going to do this carve out because he's running for office. He's running to be president. He's in a special protected category that people need to know what he's saying. And Zuckerberg uses this logic where he kind of thinks, well, you know, people will see this and they'll find it abhorrent. They'll say, well, we're America. We can't just ban all Muslims from entering the United States. And it just goes to show, I think, how little he understands his own platform or human behavior, which is that the minute they allowed that to persist on Facebook, it does go viral. And some people hate it, some people love it, but they engage with it. And Facebook's algorithms read that engagement as something that they want to promote more of. And so people see it at the top of their news feeds. And that's a pattern that plays itself out again and again and again during the Trump presidency.
And this all has ramifications around the globe. As you write, Trump's Muslim ban announcement was used by far-right leaders to take more extreme positions on Muslim immigrants and refugees. In Myanmar, several of the country's military figures pointed to Trump's Facebook posting through their own Facebook page and argued that if the U.S. could ban Muslims, Myanmar should do the same. Shira, I think this is so important for people who might think, well, yeah, Facebook, people are on it. And so there's misinformation. So what? But this really has ramifications, deadly ramifications around the globe.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you know, we have a whole chapter on Myanmar, which is, I think for me, was probably the most important chapter in the book to write. I spent time there and I remember that moment really vividly because I was in Myanmar when people were talking about Trump's Muslim ban and how, because he had done it, you know, that country should do the same. And it was just at a time where that hate speech was really taking off in Myanmar, the anti-Muslim, specifically anti-Rohingya hate speech was taking off. And I could see in real time how this had global ramifications and how leaders there and in other parts of the world thought, well, if Trump is getting away with this kind of speech, what can we get away with?
This chapter on Myanmar, I hope that you'll come back because we're almost out of time, but I would love to spend maybe even, you know, half of the show on this because it's just so incredibly important. I want to ask you a couple questions that we're getting from listeners before we end. Mary writes in, does it make any sense or difference for individuals to boycott Facebook?
You know, I hear a lot about this boycott or delete Facebook campaign, and that's a personal choice. That's not something that I don't do it. You know, I have a Facebook account, I have an Instagram account, I have a WhatsApp account. I use all of them for work, and I also use them to connect with people I know who live in other countries where that's the only way I can reach them. And so I think what's really important, if I could encourage people to take something out of our book, it's to understand the mechanism under which Facebook works and operates. And, you know, I tell children especially to think of it a little bit like sugar, where you know it's not good for you. It's probably not realistic that you're going to eliminate all sugar from your life, but you have it in moderation. You understand what it does to your body to have too much of it. And that's how I think people should really start thinking about social media.
You know, I think the other question is, and we're getting a few questions about this on email, what responsibility does Mark Zuckerberg have here? I mean, given that he had information about COVID last January from top infectious disease experts, you have to wonder, what if Zuckerberg had regular forums with these people about what was happening and what was to come, to kind of bring in factual information that could give people that kind of information rather than the noise that they're getting on these memes and in these groups?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting. Zuckerberg did what he always does in these situations, which is he doesn't want Facebook. He's not comfortable with Facebook taking a stand on many of these things. He does get in touch with the CDC, the WHO, and encourage them to create fact-finding kind of mission pages where people can go for factual information. And he does gear up Facebook to point people towards those pages. He doesn't feel comfortable going that extra step. For instance, I'm thinking of when Facebook started labeling COVID misinformation, it starts to put on this label, which says for factual information about COVID, about the pandemic, please visit the CDC. And then it directs you to a link. It didn't, they as a company didn't feel comfortable saying, this is wrong. This is just incorrect. And even when Donald Trump goes on Facebook and says that disinfectants and bleach can be used as a treatment or a cure for Facebook, that gets shared thousands of times, and they still don't feel comfortable as a company just with an outright label saying, no, please don't drink bleach. Please don't, you know, this is wrong information. UV light disinfectants isn't going to treat your COVID or cure your COVID. And, you know, maybe then link out to the CDC or whatever. But they try to always take this incredibly neutral approach. And I think a lot of experts who study misinformation argue that it's just not enough.
In our final minute, we have a lot of questions about regulation. As you write, in 2010, Facebook was the subject of a federal investigation after the Center for Digital Democracy and other groups filed a complaint with the FTC. The investigation resulted in a settlement that subjected the company to regular privacy audits. But over the next few years, the government largely left Facebook to grow, opting not to stand in the way of the Instagram and WhatsApp mergers. So what are your thoughts about where we're going in terms of government regulation? And we have about a minute left.
Right. I'm going to defer a little bit to my colleague, Cecilia Kong, who is not with me today, but which I'll just say she's the expert on Washington. She's been there for over a decade. And in interviews, she will always say that she has never seen this much energy towards regulation as she has in the last year. And it's among both Democrats and Republicans. I think she would caution that we're not going to see anything immediate. It's going to be a long and slow process, but that it does seem like Washington is moving towards some type of regulation.
Well, Shira, thanks to you and Cecilia for writing this important book, and we would love to have you back. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This is really fun.
Shira Frankel is an award-winning technology reporter for the New York Times and co-author of the new book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering the show. And thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.